2021, in response to the illegal, irresponsible, and immoral firing of 70 of our coworkers, we are officially walking out and are on strike. We encourage you to demand a refund for your food and drinks that most definitely will not come, and then join us outside on the picket line.
Alamo Brown House, downtown Brooklyn, is officially on strike.
All right, that was a great montage of some of the action of the last, 2 weeks? Starting just like 10 days ago or something?
Yeah, so we're on day 10 of this strike, but that montage is exclusively from the first night, really, during the walkout. So that's everybody, three different people at the same location, the same venue, announcing the walkout to workers and to customers.
And we are here with Jordan from the Alamo Drafthouse Union and from Cinema Workers NYC.
How's it going?
You're an employee of the downtown Brooklyn Alamo Drafthouse?
Yes. So I'm a concierge employee. I work at the box office, I call it the box office. Alamo has their own branded way of talking about it, but the front desk, really. And so I do the equivalent of box office stuff as well as customer service.
And is concierge like a hotel? That's the idea. It's like you're
we're supposed to be like the gatekeepers, and like we're supposed to have all the information about the local area and about how the theater works, all the policies, because there's a lot of them, and all that stuff.
I feel like we maybe even for our international listeners need to figure out a way to describe what Alamo Drafthouse is, right? It's a theater. It's a dinner theater, right? Essentially, Jordan.
Yeah, of course. So it's based exclusively in America. It was started in Texas, and it's a dine-in movie theater. The first of its kind, as far as I know, going back to the mid to late 90s. It was founded by Tim and Carrie League. In Austin, Texas, and it's a dine-in model where everybody can order food or drinks from their seat inside the theater before and during the show, and it gets delivered by waitstaff. It's fully stocked with like a full cocktail menu. It's a draft house, so there's a lot of beers on tap everywhere. They'll use local beers and also imports and all that stuff. And the Draft House brand also does repertory screenings, so they screen older movies, specialty screenings. They do things called movie parties where you can get props for a pricier ticket. Then, of course, they show your run-of-the-mill movies, the new movies that have come out. A lot of indies, especially the last, 10 years, they have kind of been, one of the main theaters to start really championing, the A24 stuff mm-hmm. that has gotten big and all that.
Yeah, and I've spent a lot of time at the downtown Alamo Draft House and also the really weird one in Wall Street.
Yeah. I wanted to mention the really weird one on Wall Street because our family is a Nighthawk family. Mm-hmm. Sorry. We don't
Nighthawk
do that at
all. Also unionized, or at least one location is.
So the Prospect Park Nighthawk is unionized under the same local that we are. We're thinking about unionizing when we did it, and it was all in the same kind of movement. Brooklyn did it, Alamo Brooklyn did it, then Alamo Manhattan did it, and then Nighthawk Prospect Park after, and then Cinema Village came after that.
Hell yeah.
We have to talk about the one in Manhattan, though, because Andy did. That thing is so cool and weird and cursed. It's like if people have ever out there at home in podcast land have ever seen the show Succession.
you go way underground. What I kind of like about it is you can take the subway directly there and it enters into what looks like it should be or maybe one day will be a mall. I haven't been there in about a year, but there's no stores in it. It's just liminal space. It's just like a big white hallway with
Andy, there was a pickleball arena there.
Okay. All right. So there, that's good.
6 months ago, something's moved in.
And then you go down what feels like 10 sets of escalators into the, you know, I assume the part of Wall Street where all the bankers run the world. just kidding. We don't actually think that. But you're going way down under Wall Street.
Going down under Wall Street. You keep going down these escalators.
And finally, you get to Alamo Drafthouse, the concierge. Yeah. And then you go down another flight to actually get to the theater. And down there is, I think part of Alamo's brand is it's like it really tickles the millennial nostalgia.
Yes.
And they do that so well at the Wall Street Drafthouse because they have a miniature reproduction of Kim's Video. Which was the video and record store on St. Mark's that Sean and I spent many hours browsing and talking to weirdos at in our youth.
In the 90s and 2000s, Kim's Video was like, it was like The Strand was, but for like independent indie weird VHS cassette tapes and DVDs or whatever. And yeah, as Andy said, they faithfully reproduced it, or at least like the shopping experience of it in the bottom of the lower Manhattan, similar to how like CBGB's became like a John.
Yeah, yeah.
Like shirt like retail place.
Yeah, they have that bar at Newark Airport too. But yeah, it's the you know, they it's one thing that's how old are you, Jordan?
I'm 29.
Okay. I'm 37. Sean's a little older. He's 52. one of the interesting things about growing old, at least I don't know if you'll have this experience, you might have more of a Max type feature. But for us, there's this interesting experience of like watching everything that was cool and countercultural and underground become like sold back to us.
Yes.
Which is nice, and like it's cool to go to like the Portland Airport, for example, and there's a Sub Pop record store in the terminal. But it's also a bizarre experience because Alamo Drafthouse may have started as this sort of indie movie lover thing, but now it's this national chain owned by Sony bought it after the pandemic. Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there might be this feeling of like, oh, there's this cool cinema guy at the concierge, and there's like cool sort of bespoke trailers running before the movies, and they have great repertory cinema and like Weird Wednesdays and like cool horror movie stuff there. But it's also it's increasingly become more of just a normal movie chain where they have this expectation that the workers be treated like the teenage workers at you'd imagine any small town cinema where you get paid minimum wage, you have no rights, you're expected to be there seasonally or temporarily. And so it's really cool to see cinema workers organizing and standing up for themselves and saying, we love movies and we love this to work in this industry, but we got to be treated fairly and paid fairly and not be laid off whenever you want us. So yeah, let's get back into the organizing. Let's just start with like the strike itself, because it's an interesting story about why this strike of, I think, four Alamo locations, right?
There's a strike that is in New York that is two Alamo locations. And then beginning at the same time with us, there was a location in Colorado. That is the three unionized and recognized by the company as a union locations. Mm-hmm. So we were in, the three of us were in a unique position to fight layoffs as they were announced to us, like with the intention of doing it by a specific date. That was like the beginning of the month, February. But all the other locations were notified of effective immediately layoffs on January 14th. And that was the same day that we were told, like, you know, we're seriously considering doing this. You know, it was like a threat, basically. But like, they didn't go ahead and do it because they knew that they would be breaking the law, breaking status quo, and it would be an unfair labor practice if they went ahead and did it in unilateral fashion. And they eventually did do it in a unilateral fashion, but only after realizing that they couldn't sell us the layoffs at the bargaining table.
So yeah, and so status quo, you're sort of in this transitional state with the union where you're not recognized yet, or you haven't had your vote yet?
We are recognized, and we've had a vote. We began bargaining our first contract January
so
last
don't have,
year.
So before you get the contract, there has to be this maintenance of status quo where they can't just
fire
a bunch of people. And one thing that was really funny in the we'll post all the statements in the show notes as well as fundraisers for supporting the picket lines and hardship funds for the New York and Denver locations. But one thing that was funny is that they sent you this list. The lawyer sent this list of layoffs, and he accidentally called it like union reorganization spreadsheet,
restructuring. Like he called it restructuring.
He forgot to hide the part where it's clearly retaliatory.
Yeah, and we even like asked him, you know, in the next bargaining session after that, we were like, you know, what's good with the word restructuring being on some of the stuff that you gave us with your final decision to lay people off? And he was just like, there was no reason for it. Like, you know, there's no reason for like that word or whatever. Like, all they do sometimes is just shrug their shoulders and be like, we don't really have much to say about what we're saying or what we're doing. And it's like, because they don't want to get into a conversation where it opens them up to scrutiny and to like request for information. If they talk about something like we don't have enough money, for example, which is something they don't say, they're very careful to say, to not say, because if they did say it, we'd be like, well, show us the money, show us your financials, and they are obliged to give us those, you know, that information that we ask for, as long as it's relevant to the conversation. If they don't bring it up in the conversation, if they don't recognize, you know, its relevance in the conversation, then they can continue to kind of just like stonewall us. And that's kind of what they were doing with the layoffs too. They stopped fulfilling our request for information, even the ones that, you know, all of them were relevant. But some of them, they were just like, you know, it would take us too long to put this information together, and we want to just like do the layoffs now, so we're just going to go ahead and do that by, you know, it's kind of how it went.
Is there a sense, and I hope this doesn't derail anything, and I know you're not a labor lawyer, Jordan, you're just a guy, but is there any sense that they're trying to pull all this off before or in the hopes that the NLRA gets overturned, or that they get some that Capitol gets some preferential treatment under whoever Trump is going to appoint? Or
I mean, there's a lot of speculation going around about what, like, you know, what the circumstances with the NLRB, you know, look like right now. And usually I do kind of defer to you know, my first vice president of the local is Will Bobrowski. And I usually defer to him because he's been very helpful with like explaining some of the higher up, you know, legally mumbo jumbo stuff going on. But the way that I would put it simply is that the people that we've seen fired, that the two people that we've seen fired by Trump since, you know, January, since the beginning of the year, are like at the very top level of the NLRB, which sounds great, which sounds scary, but it is like kind of like, think of it as the Supreme Court of the NLRB, where decisions only go to those people if they make it all the way up the chain through the local level, the state level, the federal level, you know, up to that point. And before it gets there, you know, this could be resolved in any number of ways, and so could anything else, you know, any other labor dispute, any other ULP charge being filed. Can be settled at the local level, and it could work just as slow, if not slower, than slower than it was before Trump, because the NLRB has always been understaffed. It's a serious problem, and it shouldn't be this understaffed, and things shouldn't work this slowly. But before, you know, before it even got that far, which I doubt that we doubt as a union that it would go that far. That there would be some kind of resolution before then, or that the, you know, a judge or an arbitrator would be like, well, this is a pretty cut and dry. Like, you laid off 70 people during status quo. It's time for you to, you know, give these people back pay, severance, whatever. And, you know, maybe there's a happier ending at the end of that. But what we're hoping is to try to make this happen sooner. And obviously the strike is not just about the layoffs. It's about the tenor and pace of negotiations since we started a year ago.
Is Alamo shut down? Did you manage to shut them down in Denver or in New York?
I don't think that they were shut down at any of their locations, but we're talking about a company and a theater that kept running during the LA wildfires. So Like, it's and I mean, like, a location in LA. I mean, you know, I don't live in LA. I'm not from there, so I don't know how far it is from wherever the fires were. But they usually try to stay open as many days a year, except for, like, the one day a year that they throw a staff appreciation party for some locations, including ours. And that's actually where we where and when we planned our strike authorization vote. So people, right, like, were actually going to a staff appreciation party, getting free drinks on the company dime, and then being like, but I still want to go on strike, though. And nice, they came and voted yes. So
you asked if it's still open. There's this someone on Twitter, Clever Girl on Twitter, posted this great thing she found on Reddit of some of the customer experience of Alamo in New York. This Reddit poster says, I just came out of the theater in Brooklyn. I didn't know about the strike until afterwards, since I came in a different entrance. They have a limited menu of basically popcorn, M&Ms, and soft drinks. They also apparently have someone in the kitchen doing limited appetizers if you ask them about it. I'm pissed I didn't know how the strike was going. I just canceled my season pass until they fixed their shit. The next user says, Saturday night they had nothing in Brooklyn and told us to go to Target to bring in food.
Hell yeah.
So the Alamo Draft House is in this kind of like new construction mall type thing where there's a Target on the second floor and then Alamo on the top floor. And I have, you know, I am a BYOB or even at Alamo. And so I have browsed the Target to like find stuff to smuggle in. And there's not a lot. not a lot of good options for a meal.
Andy always wears his JNCOs and his oversized Mets sweatshirts when he goes to Alamo Draft House. Now you know why.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned the union started about a year ago, and it's a really fascinating story about how it was inspired out of the Barbenheimer weekend, if you want to tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, so I got involved with this union drive and this organizing drive just weeks before Barbenheimer, I guess, like, really, like, about a month or two before Barbenheimer. But before I even got there, there had been years of organizing happening at Alamo. And I don't have much to say about that because I wasn't around for it. But, you know, there had been at least one attempt before that, like, almost went through. And then COVID happened, so it kind of fell to the wayside for a while, even though everybody knew that Alamo was way worse after COVID. And so by the time summer 2023 rolled around, there was an entirely separate union drive going on at our theater from the drive that I'm talking about. And it was the Projectionists. So the Projectionists at the Brooklyn, Manhattan, Staten Island, and Yonkers locations in New York were trying to unionize with IATSE. And they were, layoff isn't really the term that I would use. Sometimes they use that term because I don't really think that Alamo's done layoffs before. What I think they did with the Projectionists was not just union busting, but it was restructuring in its own right. That they were like, we're going to call Projectionists technical engineers now, and we only need one per location, so the rest of you can get out of here. And they gave them, like, you know, some severance or something, but they fought and they you know, they were filed with IATSE, but it didn't really go anywhere. The NLRB took a year, you know, aforementioned NLRB, really slow, understaffed, took a year, and it didn't end up going through. But when the restructuring was announced and it happened, and I didn't really know what else was going on, I was like, wait a second. Like, there's a filing on the website for this union, and now they're doing this restructuring. Like, I put the two and two together, and I talked to, like, you know, maybe one person about it, just like, how do you feel about this going public? Because, like, I don't want anybody to worry for their jobs. And they were like, we think that somebody should talk about it, but we can't talk about it directly. So I kind of let them insulate themselves, and I talked to somebody that was able to get the story out there, and suddenly everybody inside, you know, working at the Alamo at Brooklyn, from my perspective, was talking about how a union was possible at Alamo after years of, you know, managers like joking to our faces, like, yeah, good luck getting one of those in here, you know, something like that. And honestly, like, it was a lot of hard work, but it wasn't that difficult. So, you know, I think that we really have been killing it the past, you know, year and a half. We have a lot more work to do. And I'd say that Barbenheimer also like kind of helped people understand, like, this is like how it's going to continue to get. It's just worse and worse, like staffed even thinner and thinner, close as possible to like what isn't even a sweet spot, but just what makes them the most money. And this was before Sony even got involved, and it was actually private equity. And then, you know, of course, private equity does what it does and tries to make you more profitable, make you look prettier, to sell you off to somebody, and Sony ended up being that purchaser.
And by reducing labor costs, of course. So, yeah. So Barbenheimer is this smash hit weekend where, you know, you have people showing up in pink for Barbie, and then sullen, serious men showing up for Oppenheimer, maybe trying to do the two at the same time, and you're just sold out, like, screening after screening, people posing for photos, and you've got like a skeleton crew staff to deal with it. And this just seems like really pissed people off enough at a number of theaters that you unionized, which is,
but it was it was sort of proof of what you're saying. It was proof of concept for management that you could just run these skeleton crews, but they could still make a ton of money. You could still sling a bunch of appetizers and burgers and stuff like that. And so the Barbenheimer weekend and like the way that you were sweated was going to become the template for how working at Alamo would be moving forward. Is that the idea?
Like, that's what the idea was. And to, like, you know, Barbenheimer and, like, these other, like, crazy, like, you know, when they're projecting, like, good performance like Barbenheimer, which they did see coming, because it was all that everybody talked about for, like, about a couple weeks before then, if you're in the industry, like, they staffed us, like, just about adequately for that. But outside of those outlier scenarios where, like, you know, it's like, you know, it's not super busy, or it's even, like, slow season or whatever, or it's just, like, your average Saturday at a movie theater, you can expect short staffing, and especially during the week when it's not a Saturday, then you have even less justification to ask for more coverage or more bodies on the floor. And it can be difficult because of the way that Alamo compensates, for example, its servers, which is like where you see short staffing the most often. That business model of, like, you know, a tipped wage or whatever, and they pay them tipped minimum wage. Now they used to actually pay us more and pay the servers more. But because of that business model, they often use the tips coming in, like the tip pool, as an excuse to reduce the number of people in the department that are, you know, that are coming in for a given shift, because it's like, well, the more people you bring in, then the more the tips get split up. And it's like, well, if you reduce the number of people here, then the service suffers, and then that means less tips. So it's like, There's a kind of back and forth, and there's probably a sweet spot, but there's also probably a different scenario or a different situation that they could come up with to compensate everybody better. And they're testing it at all these other locations. They won't even touch us with it here, like, you know, service fees or whatever, because they want to use the union as an excuse for, like, anything bad that happens at the two theaters that are unionized in New York. So any kind of suffering of service is Alamo's decision, but they can, you know, when somebody who works at Alamo takes them up on it, they'll be like, well, you can blame the union for it. You know, you can blame the union for the reason that you can't get a raise because of status quo, which is not how status quo works. You can actually get a raise during status quo. You just have to ask the union, or inform the union, really, like, hey, we're going to give these people raises, which they don't do. They sometimes give people raises,
as the union would say, how dare you? That's breaking status quo.
Yeah.
By the way, I haven't been to Alamo in a couple of years, or, you know, maybe around the time the projectionist thing happened. I was, like, so disgusted by that, I haven't been back. Hopefully everything works out and I will be back. Mm-hmm. The servers there, in my experience, were always above and beyond.
Yeah.
especially with someone annoying like me, who's like, when I'm not sneaking a sandwich in tinfoil, putting in kind of annoying orders because I'm vegan. And the service there is always super, they can't talk to you like during the movie. You know, everyone's like stoned and on shrooms and vaping and shit. And so, but if you put in these like kind of annoying orders, and they always, in my experience, they always did it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. They're always on top of it. You know, it, as much as they can be, if it is short staffed, it can get really difficult to juggle, you know, like close to 100 tables at a time.
Yeah, my weird order of like, I want the pickle fries, but I don't want it fried. And also, is the ranch really vegan? You know, just like, you write it all down on a card. And they actually do
this
a pretty
good job. This is reminding me, Andy, you and I went to go see a screening of the director's cut of Apocalypse Now a couple of years ago. Do you remember
that? We went there. That was really fun.
It was like 4.5 hours worth of it. The one thing that I always, that might have been the last time I've been to Alamo, or the second to last time. One thing that I noticed about Alamo, and it's really dystopian, is like you press a button and a little light comes on, and your server is supposed to respond to that light and like come to you and take your order. Whereas at other places like Nighthawk, you just kind of like display a little piece of paper. At Alamo, there's like a Pavlovian, like a button you press, and then it like brings your human server to you. I always found that kind of weird.
Yeah, the buttons are kind of a problem, but I mean, I think that the system works because, like, to an extent, because it really just like tells us on a screen like what table number has a button press, and then we go and check it out. But if you press the button like again and again and again, it just resets the timer that's next to your table number, by the way. So just a PSA for everybody, if like you're getting, you know, a little antsy, like, you know, my water, or my food hasn't come yet, don't press the button over and over, because then it'll just look like you pressed it 30 seconds ago instead of, you know, 10 minutes ago.
So don't be that guy. It's not like when you're on the elevator and you're mashing like the close the door button, like it's doing anything, or you're pressing the fifth floor and you think that it's going faster. It's not. It's actually pissing everybody off around you and making things worse.
You mentioned Apocalypse Now. Even worse than that, I just remembered I saw Avatar the night it came out at like a 12:30 a.m. screening, and that's like a 3+ hour movie. So I just had this poor fucking server working a sold out theater of just stoned, degenerate Avatar people dressed in blue, putting in annoying Avatar cocktails, working until probably past 4 a.m. doing this.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's usually people are only there till 2 a.m. Not me though. Like the box office, we get to go home a little bit earlier than everybody else. You know, once we're done seating movies, we can head out. But the servers, the kitchen, the dish pit, the bartenders, they're around late, and they got to close their different departments. You know, sometimes it takes a long time, and people come in less than 12 hours later to do it all again. I mean, they come in at 7, 8 a.m. Sometimes our first show time of the day is like 9 a.m., which is insane.
So how have the vibes been since unionization, just amongst your coworkers? And I guess with Sony as well.
So, I mean, with unionization, which happened, you know, we officially like had our vote and we won in September 2023, you know, we had a, you know, we started nominating our bargaining committee. I'm on the bargaining committee. There's 9 of us across the 2 locations, and we're kind of like the de facto union reps. So if anybody has any questions or like, hey, like, I think I have a status quo violation, they come to us about it. And then we send out periodic emails about how bargaining has been going and stuff. And that's kind of it. Like, everything outside of that kind of felt the same. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Alamo's not supposed to change anything about policies, the way that they discipline employees, the way that they like pay or promote or do anything like that. They're not supposed to change anything while we're bargaining, at least without bargaining with us first. And so a layoff is one of those big things. It's like, well, you can't do that without getting our agreement. Or we can come up with an article, like a proposed way for how this should go. Like, you laid this amount of people off, fine. This is what they get. Severance, they get paid out their PTO, et cetera, and they get put on a recall list, something like that. And we actually had an article like that for a contract on the table, but they didn't engage with it, and then they wanted to go ahead and do a layoff. So it's like, well, we have to have a conversation about it, and they wanted to end the conversation sooner than they were allowed to. So that's kind of why we're in this position now.
Is the sense that they're testing the waters? Because obviously management prerogatives are... They're still getting used to management prerogatives being a more collaborative thing. Are they testing the water with this? Do they want you to strike?
I don't think they want us to strike. They might have been calling our bluff, you know, along the way, because we did a strike authorization vote, and like, you don't even have to tell them at the table face to face, like, did you see that we did a strike authorization? They knew. Like, managers knew about it. It's an open secret. And then when we won, or, you know, not when we won, but when the vote was yes, we put that on our Instagram and just be like, let's show the public, like, this is how we're feeling about the layoffs. Like, you know, do you really want to go through with this? Like, do they want to go through with this? And they did. So it's hard to say, like, what they're really thinking. I think that they had no choice but to do this because somebody told them to. And Sony denies that they that this is their decision at all. But that's just damage control. You know, they don't have anything else to say besides, we didn't have anything to do with this. It was an Alamo decision. And it's just like a little disingenuous and a little like, okay, well, you know, whatever. We can get on the same page, at least, that you guys want to do these layoffs so bad that you're ignoring like all the reasons, even from a business self-surviving standpoint, like, you should not do this. This will ruin your theater, even if we don't go on strike. And then we did go on strike. So now we're in this position where it's like, I think they're testing us now. Like, how long are we willing to strike for? And I can't say at this time, like, whether they have the right idea or not, because I don't want to tip our hand, really. But what I can tell you right now, and what I, you know, if they're listening, I hope that they take me seriously on this, that people absolutely believe in fighting until we actually get something out of this, and until we get taken seriously at the table. People are feeling like, you know, a bit of fear about the fact that we haven't heard from the company, really, except for, like, you know, we asked them to provide some information to us about something else, and they said they would give it to us, like, later, basically. And so we have bargaining scheduled with them on, I forget the exact date, but the first week of March. So if they don't want to meet with us in an emergency session before then we'll see them that day. You know, and if they want to cancel that, then I think we have a lot more to talk about and a lot more planning to do.
I mean, it sounds like you're doing a lot of damage, or like they're doing a lot of damage by not coming to the table, because like the idea, you know, people go to Alamo because they want to see the movie, and then they're like willing to spend $50 per person on a cocktail and a burger, mm-hmm. and you show up and you're lucky if you get any food, and they're telling you to go down to Target. And it's like, you know, not only are people going to maybe not enjoy their time during the strike, no matter what they think about the workers or the issue, they're probably not going to want to come back. Like, I can smuggle in some hummus to any theater. You know, I don't have to go to Alamo.
Isn't the sense, and maybe this is why private equity and Sony got involved, the sense that I get is the traditional theater is sort of dying, you know, or at least like not living up to profit expectations. And so the Alamo Drafthouse model, or the Nighthawk model, the dinner theater model, is that it's like an experience. Like, you're having something that you can't get at home streaming Netflix, for example, yeah, right?
Experience economy.
Yeah, I mean, actually, like the Sony acquisition of Alamo is how they kind of announced, like, we have a new division. It's called Sony Pictures Experiences. That's what we're a part of, you know.
Yeah.
And by the way, the CEO of Alamo is also heading that division. So if it was his decision to do the layoffs, then it is a Sony decision, because he's a Sony appointee.
Let's talk a little bit about just organizing like nuts and bolts. Like, you know, we probably have a lot of listeners that work in theaters or, you know, similar service type jobs. What are some things that like really helped? Like, what are some tips that you could share?
So I would say that you have to pay attention to the timing of things. You know, people do want to go to work and have a normal day of work and keep their head down, and all power to them. And, you know, sometimes they do think of this job as like, this is temporary, I want to get out of here. But if you want to convince people like that this job is worth fighting for, that can't just come from you. It has to come from them, like from inside them. So, whether you know your coworkers well enough to do that or not, you have to show them how sincere you are in fighting for each other, because more like with the strike right now, more than ever, I'm learning that like I've been doing all this, and we've all been doing all of this like out of love and respect for each other. And that's not, you know, sometimes it's not mutual, sometimes it's not all across the board, but there's a lot of us that we just like we want to continue to work together and be happy doing it. We like our jobs, you know, at least a lot of us do. I personally do. I just want to be respected at the job. So I think that telling people that that there's no way to get taken seriously by your employer without actual leverage and without popular consensus within your workplace, that's why unions are necessary. And unions, the power of a union can extend far beyond your workplace. And we learned that pretty much right away with Alamo, that we were inspiring other movie theaters, and other movie theaters came before us. But like, you know, Nighthawk being the same business model, we showed Nighthawk like this can be done, and the time to do it is now. And they came and they followed in our footsteps.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And also, you know, just thinking about that building, that downtown, what's that building called?
The Lower Manhattan one?
No, the downtown Brooklyn.
Oh, City Point.
Yeah, the City That's Point the building. Mall, yeah. It's, yeah, so...
is that the one on Flatbush Avenue?
It's on Fulton. It's like the Fulton...
Fulton, Flatbush, Willoughby. There's like five streets that touch it. It's next to the City Tower, the Dark Tower, I call it, in downtown Brooklyn.
Tower, yes, the store
right
on...
Right next to it, yeah. Tower,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a... So, we mentioned there's a Target, which is Union, and then below that, there's like a mall level, including a McNally Jackson, which we go to.
Great.
I think that's unionized. I know they had a union. Okay, so they had a union campaign in 2020 that they won, and then a floor below that is like a food hall with a Trader Joe's in it. And so, and there's also ongoing union struggles at Trader Joe's. So this whole building, you know, that like, you know, D class A millennials like me go and spend an afternoon at is. It's just a hotbed of union activity. So obviously Sean sees a little bit more of the building trades union stuff, but someone like me can see, you know, top to bottom class struggle at this, you know, bespoke experience economy of Brooklyn.
And the reason why we call it the Dark Tower is because it's black. And like at the top, you can imagine like the Eye of Sauron. It's like, you know, like those two little horns with the eye. But instead of it being evil like Sauron, that's like the eye of organized labor, like looking out across the city and around the world, like looking for any place that's unorganized, trying to bring it into the system. That's our Dark Tower, baby.
Yeah, and like within City Point, like, you know, within this mall, I feel like, and I hope somebody can correct me somewhere, maybe on the internet or whatever, but like, I don't know if there's been a scabby outside of this building before. You know, I don't know if there's been a strike outside this building before, whether it's like the culture workers of the establishments that are inside, or whether it's like the electricians or, you know, the carpentry or anybody that works in that building, if they had a strike or an ongoing labor dispute there. But it is... I feel like it could soon become that hotbed that you're talking about of labor organizing and union activity, because like McNally is union and that's there. That Trader Joe's isn't unionized, but Trader Joe's does have an ongoing fight that I hope spreads to other locations. And It's funny you brought up that pickleball place at the other building, but that one, that company opened up another location right next to Alamo at City Point. So they're, it's like weird that they're like, they're also present at both the New York locations.
Organize the pickleball workers.
Yeah, that's like what you know, they're kind of friendly with us. We could see what they want to do. But
I have a theory about this. I haven't really looked into this, but I've noticed that a lot of these new construction buildings have like either the pickleball thing is new to me, but before there were these like ping pong pods. Have you seen these? Like,
yeah,
it'll be like a condo building, and then on the ground floor where there should be a store or you know some sort of retail space, mm-hmm. there's just like a lone ping pong table that no one uses, and I feel like there's some sort of like New York State tax incentive to have like a physical like some sort of like you know I think these buildings have to have a retail space. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's an additional incentive if it's something like sports related. So maybe. they'll just put like a ping pong table in there that you could theoretically rent out with an app or something.
Yeah.
Maybe pickleball or something similar.
Right. Yeah, just like bars like in New York City can get their licenses a lot easier if they provide food.
Right.
So every shitty little dive bar has one of those hot dog roller things. And like technically you could buy one. Like a $2 hot dog that's been on that roller for 7 weeks, but nobody ever does. It's like that with pinball.
We'll have some pickleball workers on for a future episode to figure it out.
Yeah, you know, I've been intrigued by this struggle. You know, it came across our transom, Jordan. Now we have you on, and I was looking into historically if there's any precedence for this, and of course there is, right? I've got an article right here, Dateline, February 28th, 1934, New York. Movie ushers vote for general strike. This is in the New York Times.
Great Depression. Pre-CIO.
Yeah.
Post-NLRA, pre-CIO.
It was a special time, a chaotic moment. 20,000 workers expected to be affected. Labor board calls conference today. A general strike of ushers and other front of house workers employed in motion picture theaters of the city was voted yesterday morning by members of the Theater and Amusement Employees Union at an all-night meeting in Palm Garden on Fifth Avenue. Plans for a general strike were formulated later at a meeting of the union's executive committee at a union headquarters. So this happened historically in this very propitious and wild time for American labor when, you know, union leaders like Charles C. Levy, who is the secretary and treasurer of this union, could say the president wants you to form a union, could say that to workers. And then, you know, they would vote and then you'd vote general strike and blah, blah, blah. I tried to find evidence of this union moving forward from 1934. Into maybe the 50s, the AFL-CIO era, but there's no mention of them whatsoever. So if any listeners out there are labor historians and know anything about Local 113 of the Theater and Amusement Employees Union, you know, leave it in the show notes. I'm sure we got some sleuths out there. But like the broader question, right, is that like, is this a moment where it's going to be possible to organize service sector workers in a sustainable way? Because in the 1930s, when you had millions upon millions upon millions of workers organizing industrially across whole industries and sectors of the economy, you were able to get unionism in like certain bespoke sort of service sectors, like what's his name? Anthony Bourdain, rest in peace, mm-hmm. in his book Kitchen Confidential, famously writes about interacting with like the crazy mobbed up union at the Rainbow Room in Rockefeller Center when he first starts in like the 1970s and
my dad almost joined that union actually.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Told me that story that he wanted to join. He thought about joining the Rainbow Room union. He's a chef, and so he almost joined that union, but he didn't, and he said that he regrets it. I don't know much about the history there, but I just thought I'd chime in with that.
No, I think it's important that you bring that up as, you know, it being your father's history, right? And now you're making your own history right now. I wonder if we look, the three of us, you know, just as working people, at what the economy looks like right now, what politics looks like right now. Is what is your strike? What is this strike, Jordan, in the larger perspective of things? Starbucks union, for example, was like a pet project here in the city going back 25 years, 30. I remember the IWW used to do stuff, and they used to do little informational pickets all the time outside of the Starbucks and Astor Place. Well, now, you know, 20, 25 years down the line, the Starbucks union's like an actual thing, and they were able to break through in a way that they weren't maybe in the 90s or the 2000s. So where do you put the Alamo strike in the larger context of society and the economy right now?
So I think that organizing the service sector and service related jobs is crucial. And it has been crucial for some time. And I love the pace that it might be taking now, but that where we are definitely falling behind, or we have fallen behind. We should have been organizing these spaces like before probably before I was even born. I was born in 95, but like the past 20 years for sure, we saw the way that corporate America has, you know, left their locations, their franchises, their footprints all over pretty much every neighborhood across the world, and especially in America. And it's difficult to really wrap your head around it sometimes. Like, how can we like regain our footing, especially now under the current administration? Like, we don't know what could go, you know, what way, like, you know, what could turn out to be a historic win or what could just be like ongoing perpetual suffering, you know? But I think that, and I feel this way about the Alamo strike right now, like, you know, we are on day 10 of the strike, I believe, now, or day 9. No word from the company, no interest in coming to the table, right? And what we've been telling our members that are, you know, a little skeptical about how much Alamo cares about the damage that we're doing, which we are undeniably doing a lot of damage in the press, and we're doing damage to their bottom line. I believe, you know, we've estimated that we've cost them $500,000 since the beginning of the strike. And what we tell our members that are a little skeptical about, like, well, Alamo doesn't seem to really care, you know, what, like, why should we keep going when they will just take whatever hit that they think that they can take? And, you know, maybe they are ruining their business and they don't know what's better for themselves, but like, you know, how do we win? And it's like, well, you don't do it by giving up now. You don't do it by giving up, like, before another opening weekend of another big movie to come out. One of the few big movies to come out this quarter is The Monkey, and that's this weekend, right? We were like, well, we can't do this now because our, you know, the people that would support this union and the strike are probably the crossover audience to The Monkey, you know, horror fans that are going to Alamo Drafthouse for their beer, you know, and their burgers or whatever to see a movie. You know, we have to let them know we're on strike, do not cross this picket line. And I believe that they've been listening to us and taking us seriously. And so when it comes to the industry or the sector, really, like, Starbucks is obviously not going to give up anytime soon. They don't have a contract yet, but they have, I don't even know, hundreds, thousands of stores, and how many, God knows how many, you know, partners or whatever Starbucks calls them, co-workers, you know, unionized. And, like, you know, that can't just simply go away unless everybody votes out the union. And I don't think that's going to happen. So they have to keep fighting, even though it's against one of the biggest, like, service corporations like Starbucks. You know, whether you're Trader Joe's or whether you're, I don't know, whether you're McNally Jackson, you know, kind of not a small bookstore, but what used to be an independent bookstore. You have to keep fighting because it's just like the timing of it all is, if you stop fighting now, you will lose way more than you will lose if you fight on your two feet, you know, on your own two feet.
Not only that, and hopefully this will be the case with your union, but the traditional calculus is that, well, you know, obviously it's hard for the workers to lose, you know, especially if you like you weren't facing the layoff. You know, you're now missing shifts for an indeterminate amount of time. That's difficult, but you're costing the company exponentially more money. And then if you win, you will not only have better workplace conditions, but you will have you'll protect your wage in the long run. Mm-hmm. So the calculus is almost always a win for the union, despite the pain of like the work stoppage. And, yeah, obviously it's very difficult to convince your coworkers, especially if they're not like union militants, that that's going to pay off, you know. Mm-hmm. But historically, that does tend to be the case, right?
Yeah.
I guess the question, right, is, and you mentioned this, Jordan, when you were talking about what it takes to organize. The question is, like, are we willing to accept that a job at, say, the downtown Brooklyn location of Alamo Drafthouse is one that should be performed with dignity, that the workers there should have some say in their hours, that it should be a year-long job, not one prone to like high season and low season, mm-hmm. that it should be a job that one can make a living off of, as opposed to what service sector jobs have been seen as, or I guess you could say propagandized as, which is a job for like teenagers and high school or whatever. I think that's less and less the case, but it still sounds like something that you need to confront, that like this job actually does matter, that the conditions actually do matter. Alamo Drafthouse, people do depend on this job to survive, to make a living, to pay their rent, to buy food and everything. So maybe like this is a broader question we're asking ourselves as a society, is what is a Starbucks job worth? What is an Alamo Drafthouse job worth? Are these careers ultimately, are these things that people are going to make a living off of, or are they just temporary jobs people take on their route to something else? Well, it doesn't seem that the something else is really arising anymore, but go on.
Yeah, I mean, like, and I think that it's a real problem a lot of the time. And, you know, I don't think that this is actually a popular, like a too popular a sentiment, but I think that this kind of, like you have to evaluate, like, a job based on, like, how long it can take you or carry you, and like whether or not it's worth it to unionize or to be in a union for that job. Like, it's like every job, every worker in America deserves dignity. You know, like you wouldn't say that, like, somebody that, I don't know, somebody that like picks up garbage for a living for the city, like, doesn't deserve dignity because they're picking up garbage. It's like, no, they do. And that's why they have a union, you know, that they're a city worker. And even if they weren't a city worker and they were like working for a private corporation picking up garbage, they still do the same. You know, I don't know if like the downtown Brooklyn sanitation workers that you see around all the time, I don't know if they're public workers, but I'm curious if they have a union. But I think that everybody from them to the movie theater workers in my theater, the movie theater workers at AMC theaters that are, you know, 18, 19, younger even, and walk around a lobby sweeping up trash as well, or scooping popcorn into a bucket, which isn't really what we do at Alamo, by the way. They deserve a union. Like, they all deserve unions. They all deserve dignity and respect from their employer, because those are the jobs where they really try to fuck you over. And
what?
And like muscle you out of the dignity and the respect that you deserve. So that's why you need a union. You need worker power. You need to band together and fight for what you deserve, you know?
And why I think that this is part of, even though obviously you need to focus on the individual workplaces you're in and your independent individual jobs, you know, the way that the trash gets cleaned up on the street since the 1970s in New York City is something called a business district fund, that like all the small businesses and medium-sized businesses in a retail area come together and they outsource like the picking up of trash and the cleaning of the sidewalks and the streets to some corporation, or the NGOs come around with something like the Doe Fund, and
right
to live right by one of the centers for the Doe Fund, where it's like they you get homeless people who are hard, you know, down on their luck and need a job. You the Doe Fund pays them to go and clean up areas, I guess, like based on grant money from the city or the state. But the point is like all of this work is because in the 1970s, due to austerity, the city of New York stopped cleaning the streets. Sanitation workers were no longer union sanitation workers. Teamsters were no longer paid a living wage in order to clean up. So it becomes a sort of privatized thing that local businesses get someone from the outside to come in, or NGOs like exploit the homeless to do these things. So there are real stakes, like larger societal stakes, which is that if we allow jobs to continue to get worse and worse, conditions to stay shittier and shittier, like what happens at your restaurant / movie theater does affect the broader society, because all jobs get worse and all jobs are getting worse and they get replaced by shittier and shittier ones, just as movies get replaced by AI slop, right? Or like streaming Netflix bullshit that we get advertised all the time and never watch.
One thought that I had, knowing so little about Alamo's business model and like the dynamics of running a successful movie theater is one of their justifications for these layoffs was that, well, this is the slow season, Oscar season's over, people are going to be seeing less movies until the summer. But Alamo's in a pretty good position for that because they do show repertory stuff, and they, as far as I can tell, they do pretty well. You know, mm-hmm. I think some of the repertory horror movies they show like tend to sell out. So it seemed like they could just shift to that and keep filling up the theater. But that, I guess, would demand more kind of like in-house programming, maybe. But anyway, that was just one of the ideas that I had that's along the lines of something that I was thinking about, because you and I showed the Dolly Parton film 9 to 5 at Woodbine a couple weeks ago, which is a movie about three women working in a corporate office, being in various ways abused and harassed by their piggish boss, and they, you know, band together and kidnap their boss and start running the office themselves using the ideas that the boss had always stolen from them for his own career. And after a month of this guy being hogtied in his home, the big boss comes to the office and is like, wow, this is now the best office in the country. Like, everyone is so happy here. Like, all
streamlined,
all of the reforms that you've put in have really turned this business around. And so I don't know, is there the sense of you and among some of your coworkers that, like, if you were just able to control the business a little better, not only in terms of like how the service works, but also what you show and the experience in general, if that was just more in the hands of the workers who like want to show that initiative, like maybe Alamo could be an even better place, like closer to that film nerd experience that people go to Alamo because it brands itself that way.
Yeah, I mean, like so many people that work at my theater feel that way, and I feel it so strongly sometimes sitting at the box office or talking to customers about movies. And you know, I look at the schedule and I'm like, why is it so slow today? You know, why did they make decisions this way, right? And usually it comes down to like studio contracts, like the way that the distribution model works. And it's like, maybe that's like a little too ironclad for us to make a dent in just yet. But I think that the strike could be a path forward into the question of, well, if studios just get what they want all the time, you know, Disney gets to muscle out other movies and other studios from a theater just because they think that theirs is going to be the most popular, or Sony gets to buy a movie theater and play only their trailers in front of movies, then, like, you know, it sounds like a depressing situation, because, like, how do you fight that? Well, the fact that we're on strike to begin with, I think, shows that that we can exercise our power and our right to withhold our labor over things within legal confines, right? Like something like status quo, and we can also, I don't know, we can bargain about things like this, like their business decisions or whatever, but it is not mandatory. Like, those aren't mandatory subjects of bargaining. They're permissive, so they probably would never really talk to us about that stuff. And we actually had plans to talk about something along those lines the day that they announced these announced those layoffs, like originally, because as a union, we vocally and publicly opposed Alamo Brooklyn screening September 5th, which is like I'll just go out and call it a Zionist movie, but it's like, it's more just like operating under the like overall Zionist agenda.
Well, it's not a Zionist movie in the sense that like The Brutalist maybe is a Zionist. It's like propaganda, right?
Yeah, straight up. Like it. Yeah, September 5th is like propaganda, but it's also like about the heroes of journalists or whatever, which I thought was very distasteful. Because it's about Western journalists, like Western German journalists or American journalists, at a time when Palestinian journalists are like sought out and murdered, you know, regularly. And it was about Munich, obviously. And so we opposed having to serve this because our workers, you know, our coworkers, our members didn't feel comfortable doing it. And we had this big petition and it got a lot of signatures, and it even got both positive and negative press attention. Times of Israel like posted something about it. We presented them with the petition. We said that we would talk about it X day. I think it was like January 15th or 16th. And then the January 14th, we had layoffs to talk about. So it's like, it kind of steamrolled over the conversation. Eventually they stopped showing that movie. So,
wow, you know, interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would not want to have to like work in that theater. And just the trailer of that was so odious.
Yeah. I had to watch that trailer when I, actually was seeing a movie. I was seeing Juror number 2.
Great movie.
Or was it Juror 8?
Juror number 2.
Is it Juror number 2?
Yeah.
I'm thinking Juror number 8 because of 12 Angry Men, I think.
I know it's Juror number 2 because I tweeted a song number 2 parody song about Juror number 2.
I like Juror number 2 a lot, but yeah, I saw the trailer for September 5th before that and I was like, oh, is this about Munich? Like, I didn't even hear about this movie until I saw the trailer, and I was like, we better not be getting that here. And then, you know, when we found out, we took action. But going back to like the original topic or question, I think that Alamo should definitely listen to their workers more often about programming ideas or decisions, because we're actually the ones interacting with customers about movies, and we also represent the clientele and local community that Alamo is supposed to serve. So, you know, Alamo dedicating the Brooklyn Theater to Spike Lee is, you know, an active community. It's like, okay, yeah, we're in Brooklyn, Spike Lee's from Brooklyn, and we did a whole series of his movies and stuff. You know, that's a good idea, but I don't really see it as anything beyond Tim League trying to meet his hero or something, which he did get to do. But when it comes to, you know, programming decisions, Alamo used to have like a programmer in-house in each venue, and that's not the case anymore. I don't know if it was at every venue. I used to work at the Yonkers location as well, and a friend of mine out of college got the job at the Yonkers location of being a programmer, but didn't last long because of COVID. And so now programming is done by like regional managers and regional programmers, like way higher up in corporate. They're not really in touch with us. And it's not to say that they're like doing a bad job or whatever. I think that they are kind of stuck with a lot of contracts that they have to navigate around. And isn't it just like terrible for the business to just like have to fulfill contractual obligations to screen a movie that nobody's clearly going to see? Like, it's kind of a shame, you know?
Well, you know, if they're going to turn over the Brooklyn Alamo Draft House to Spike Lee as a Brooklyn boy, I mean, I respect that. But you also should probably turn it over to like all Zionist movies, since many of the people buying properties in the West Bank also come from Brooklyn. So as like a community thing, you know, Amazon Brooklyn should turn it over to like Settler Night or something like that. My attempt at dark humor.
Maybe a different part of Brooklyn that could work. But yeah, part of what's cool about Alamo Drafthouse is it's got a, you know, it's in a very black area. And it has a very black audience, so it's you know, it's a good, like, it is a very, you know, it's a very sort of contrived place, you know, sort of a recreation of this local Austin movie house. Mm-hmm. But in downtown Brooklyn, it does have a very neighborhood vibe, which I always really appreciated about it until the, you know, they like fucked over their projectionist and I canceled my season pass.
The Applebee's in downtown Brooklyn off DeKalb was pretty neighborhood too. And yeah, Applebee's, when you're here, you're family.
And shout out to the Regal used to be on Court Street, because the Regal on Court Street shut down. And I feel like when it shut down, like everybody in the neighborhood like really mourned it. Mm-hmm. And then Alamo, my theater became like the main, I guess, like, I don't know. You can't really call Alamo a multiplex, but it's like similar to a multiplex. You show like more popular movies as opposed to like BAM's art house offering, for example. But that now everybody goes to Alamo. So we, you know, we have a lot of power, you know, as workers at the only like major movie theater in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. you know, like anywhere near like downtown, everybody else would have to go to like something like Sheepshead Bay or into Manhattan.
Yeah, Williamsburg has it's a multiplex, right?
Yeah, I got Williamsburg Cinemas.
But yeah, mm-hmm. Sheepshead, King's Highway, I don't know.
And then there's Nighthawk, obviously, in Williamsburg and in Prospect Park.
And then, of course, my favorite theater in New York, Spectacle.
Yeah, Spectacle is also in Williamsburg.
Not a multiplex. No. Far from that. But yeah, I mean, like, people love Spectacle. People love Anthology, but I think those same people, you know, want to go to something like Alamo too. And like, especially with these passes, you know, it's like, you know, if Alamo's on strike, if they're fucking over their workers, it's kind of an easy choice to just go to AMC instead, if you do want that, that like corporate multiplex experience. Mm-hmm. Unless there's anything else you want to talk about, maybe we can wrap up and talk a little bit about how people can support.
The best way to support us is to simply do nothing and not go to Alamo Drafthouse. But definitely follow us on Instagram at NYC Alamo United, and that's where the public will hear first that we've, we've called off the strike or returned to the table. You know, we're not asking everybody to boycott Alamo indefinitely or forever. But follow us on Instagram, and in the link in our bio, you'll see fundraisers for two separate fundraisers for our laid off folks and then for the folks that are on strike right now. Those two groups obviously are kind of the same group. We're all striking together because some of the laid off folks obviously are still sticking around hoping that they get their jobs back. But for the purposes of distributing funds to support in this crucial time, we split our fundraisers. So donate to both or whichever, share. And other than that, please come to a picket line, show your support. We've gotten a lot of people showing up, but now that the weather is warmer here in New York compared to the last week of like stormy, cold, windy, we're hoping that we're having a really loud second wind coming our way.
Hell yeah. I saw there was some great sandwiches at one of the pickets, so I'll try to stop by for some snacks.
And please buy us food, buy us coffee, you know, whatever you want to bring. We don't need the hand warmers anymore, at least not right now. But
hopefully the hand warmer days are over. In the show notes, there'll be a link to beacons.ai/New York City Alamo United. And that has all the information and links you need, including their statement, which is really interesting. And then all of the funds to donate to the New York City workers, to the Denver workers, and press coverage. So all that's in the show notes. And then do you want to talk about Cinema Workers NYC as well?
Yeah, I mean, real quick, there's a group called Cinema Workers NYC. You can also find them on Instagram by that same name. And I'm a part of that group. So it's more like a collective of organizers in the New York area who work at movie theaters in various positions that in general what we want is sectoral organizing. So we want to see other, you know, community movie theaters in New York start to push for their own union efforts. And you know, if you're out there and you know that your union is you know, or that you are organizing a union, or that you're interested in organizing a union, or you're looking for help or guidance in how to do that, where to start, it can be very intimidating or daunting. But you can reach out to us through Instagram there. We have an email list that you can subscribe to for like updates. We hold meetings and socials every once in a while, so you can come out to those and either see a movie like the 9 to 5 screening that we did, or something like go to a bar. You know, we email out updates about what we're planning on doing, and just come out and say hi, get to know us if there's any way we can support you as cinema workers, or even if you're not working at a movie theater, come out and say hi and express your support. And if you're looking for help with a union effort, you can talk to us as well.
Awesome. Very exciting project. Anything, any closing thoughts, Sean?
No, I would say I love movies. Andy loves movies. Jordan, it sounds like you love movies. We should be, of course, supporting venues where the workers helping to show us those movies and make our experience good are being compensated fairly, and their schedules are fair, and they can make a living off of it if that's what they're intending to do. So 100% support what you're doing, not just for unions, not just for yourself, but also more broadly for the arts, I guess, right?
Because yeah, of course.
We all love films.
Absolutely.
All right, Jordan, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Solidarity and best of luck.
Thank you.
Go on. Thanks.
It's all of you, it's all of the teachers, it's all of the parents, it's all of the writers, the artists, the musicians, all the wonderful people make this place work. All the wonderful people make this the number one Alamo in the country. And this is how we remind corporate that it's not because of movies and popcorn, it's because of the people. I understand being scared, and I understand wondering if this is the right thing to do, but I promise you, this is the right thing to do, because I also understand that while they don't have to hear just one of us, they absolutely have to hear all of us. I forgot my shit downstairs, I'm sorry, I'm running down to grab it, and then I'm walking, I hope you guys join me.